we take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Simon.
And welcome back to the show, listeners. Tonight we are going to be talking about the Prisoner episode, Dance of the Dead. Or as autocorrect on my iPad typed it in, Dance of the Dentist.
Well, you never know with the Prisoner, do you?
Sometimes it's true. Start with a summary of the episode. It is night in the village, and Number 6 is sound asleep. A group of doctors enter his room and connect him to electronic equipment. In the control room, a doctor uses Dutton, a former associate of Number 6, to attempt to interrogate him. Despite the obvious nervousness of this night's supervisor, because the doctor clearly doesn't have permission from Number 2 to interrogate 6, and the standing orders are not to use techniques that could kill or damage 6 in any way. The interrogation is failing, and Number 2 arrives just in time to stop it. Number 6 must come over to their side willingly. It may take a long time, but he will. It is morning in the village, and everyone is preparing for the carnival. Number 2 talks with Number 6. She encourages him to come to carnival and find a nice, unattached female. Number 2 suggests a group of suitable young ladies at a table, but instead, Number 6 goes to talk to the one girl Number 2 said was unsuitable. Is he doing what he wants to be an individual, or has he been played into doing what Number 2 wants? Even Number 6 isn't sure. The girl evades talking to Number 6 and gets away as soon as possible. Number 6 follows, but Rover slows him down, but doesn't stop him. Eventually, the girl enters Town Hall. Number 6 is stopped by an electronic force field at the door. Only authorized people are allowed in. Inside the control room, it is revealed the girl Number 6 was following is his observer. Later, Number 6 comments to the maid that he never sees night, just sleep. He realizes then that they drug him every night. That night, he doesn't drink his nightly drink, and he goes to sleep on the chair. After a while, a hypnotic voice enters his room. He resists, and finally leaves via the window. His observer sees this and reports it to Number 2, but she is unconcerned. Their security will stop him, and he will eventually return to his room, the only place he has to go. Rover meets 6 on the beach, and dogs him until he gives up. But rather than returning to his room, he sleeps on the beach. In the morning, he finds a dead sailor washed ashore. From the body, he retrieves a small radio and his personal papers. He hides the body in a cave. Returning to his room, his costume has arrived for carnival. He will be going as himself. Later, he attempts to use the radio. It works, but the signal he picks up speaks in a curious, nonsensical way. Number 2 and the observer arrive. Number 6 hands over the radio. Later, though, 6 takes a life preserver from the stone boat and returns to the cave. He writes a note, attaches it to the body, ties the body into the life preserver, and sets it to float on the tide. Dutton is watching him. They talk. Dutton has been here for a while. He admits to telling them everything, but he doesn't know what they want. Soon, they will kill him. At the carnival, 6 dances with his observer, but when she won't give him information, he leaves and starts exploring Town Hall. Most of it is locked, but he finds his way to the morgue, where he finds the body of the dead sailor he set out to see. Number 2 is there, and she explains that, after some work, that body will be him. He will be dead to the outside world. Returning to the carnival in time for the promised cabaret, the entertainment turns out to be the trial of Number 6. His crime? Having a radio. Prosecution is his observer. His defense is Number 2. Number 6 calls his own witness, Dutton. But when Dutton arrives, he is a drooling idiot, dressed as a fool. Number 6 is sentenced to death at the hands of the Villagers. They chase him with murderous intent. He eventually escapes into the room where he thinks Number 1 is, but it is just a teletype. He destroys it. Number 2 comes in to tell him that he's dead now, and the broken teletype starts to work again. Number 6 is still a prisoner in the village. So did you notice that this was written by the same author who wrote Many Happy Returns last week's episode?
I didn't spot that, no.
Same guy, Anthony Skeen, I believe it is, which just goes to show you he has more than one style in his arsenal. So what did you think of this episode?
Well, one of the things that struck me most about it was it feels really out of sequence.
Oh, yeah.
It seems One of the early episodes, I remember commenting, it might actually have been The Chimes of Big Ben. I remember commenting that number six seemed to have been in the village for a while. He was behaving a bit like an old lag. He had that kind of very suspicious temperament. He knew his way around. He knew how to behave. And of course, it's perfectly possible that between the first episode, which introduces the village, and the second episode, you could say several months have passed by. But then along comes an episode like this, where there are a number of things. I mean, he actually says that he's new here, but also the fact that he discovers that he's being drugged every night. The kind of dawning of ideas that he might be, you know, is he rebelling against number two, or did number two expect him to rebel like that? Now, that's
getting
exactly
into town hall. It's like this is like the first time he's ever seen town hall before.
Yes, yes, exactly. And some of those things are, they feel like very typical prisonerish things. The idea that maybe he's being led a certain way, even though he thinks he's exploring or being able to break into a hidden room or whatever, but in fact he's being led. Those kind of things are very much what we have seen in all the other episodes that we've watched already. But these episodes seem, this episode at least, it seems a bit mild, I suppose, is the word by comparison. Some of the other episodes have had far more complex and opaque kind of double, triple bluffs in them than what we're getting in this one.
Yeah, and I agree that this does feel well out of sequence. I would almost say that this episode should be second or third in sequence, because we're setting up the notion that he is dead to the outside world.
That's another kind of introductory thing that we haven't had.
And we say the town hall, he just realizes that basically he's being drugged every night. He has cottoned on that the TV is constantly watching him, because he just turns to number two on the screen and talks to her as if he knows she's there.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "How did I sleep last night?" And, you know, instantly she's there to answer his question. Free for All was also an episode that I felt had been held back a little too long in terms of his getting accustomed to the village. And we're also kind of back to that in Free for All. It was a lot about democracy. And again, we have a lot of talk about democracy in this episode, even though.
Yes. Yes. Number two says we are a democracy, which is an interesting thing to say if this one takes place after Free for All.
Right. Right. So everything about this episode just screams really, really early. And I think it's a mistake to have held it back. I think it's very jarring
when you
come at it as episode eight and you're like, you're just now figuring that out? I thought you were the smart guy.
Yeah. I mean, it does feel completely wrong. And it's not that in any way it's not an enjoyable episode. And I think when we discussed Free for All and maybe then mentioned the fact that it was an earlier episode, I think it's early in the production order as well, isn't it?
Yes.
That the network people might have decided to hold it back because it wasn't as strong an episode as some of the others. So they were bringing forward some of the show that they wanted to, as it were, showcase to hook the viewers who were still deciding whether it was a good show or not. But to me, this one, I thought it was a very enjoyable episode. Certainly not one of the strongest, but nor was it one of the weakest. And because of all of the introductory elements, I think it would have made a good episode too. And it would have been much more enjoyable in that position because of all of these things being new to us, the viewer, just as they were new to number six, the prisoner.
I am not a big fan of this episode. It's low on my scale of enjoyable episodes in The Prisoner. But I will say this one probably benefits more from repeated viewing, because it's very it's unclear to me what Dance of the Dead refers to on first viewing of the episode. And really, as I've gone through it a few times, it's like, oh yeah, there's far more references to that. I think the choice of Peter Pan and Bo Peep were probably the biggest mistakes, because otherwise, basically everyone's a historical figure. Historical figures are all dead. It is number six is coming to this as himself, a live man, and joining the ranks of the dead. But I didn't, I just basically put it off as, frankly, too many drugs when the guy was writing it the first time I watched it. It's like, okay, this is one of those episodes that people go, I just can't make sense out of The Prisoner. It just like, I either, referring to that quote from we had last week about whether or not people don't understand what's going on, I felt there was a lot of loose ends in this story that just really didn't, you know, they were surrealistic.
Maybe I wasn't paying enough attention then.
I feel that they were, this one's one of those ones where the village has taken on an altered state of reality, kind of. And so you can't quite expect it to make perfect sense. But
it seemed quite I hesitate to say this, but a relatively straightforward episode.
Did they place the body there for him to find?
In the morgue?
In the water.
Oh, in the water.
In the first place.
I'm not sure. I mean, they could have done, but in a way that doesn't matter.
Because this whole thing to me feels like they are, like I said, as the Dance of the Dead, and he's coming as himself, the dead man, as it were. That started earlier in the episode. So it feels like they were planning his trial all the way. They were talking about the cabaret at the very beginning, and he is the cabaret. So it feels like they've led him to the point where he's going to be convicted of having that radio. But to do that, he had to find the radio.
Oh, but
so the body had to be there.
They could have convicted him of anything, because
I suppose
presumably the sentence would be death. Whatever minor transgression, certainly having a radio doesn't deserve such a severe sentence. So I don't think they'd have had a problem finding something for him to be guilty of. But also, I did kind of feel that trial seemed to me not that significant. It almost seemed to be a way of passing the time at the party, because again, I don't know whether if you were viewing this as the second episode you'd think about it in this way, but as it's mentioned in this episode and as it has been hammered home so many times to us if we've seen more episodes, they're not going to harm number six. So the idea that he was sentenced to death, you know, is going to be some kind of game.
Yes, I suppose. Yes, I certainly further along down the line. If it was in the second episode, I mean, they tell us at the beginning of the episode, in no uncertain terms, he's too valuable. We don't want to harm him. That's that whole kind of out of place sequence in the middle of the night.
Yeah,
where they, you know, make sure there's no physical. And again, that kind of falls back to what should be explained in the first episodes. This person is too important. We can't damage him. So it sets up the premise. But at the same time, is it not possible that there is some actual physical jeopardy for him? I mean, they keep telling him that there are things that could happen, that if he doesn't come around, he could end up dead. And so do we take it from this that, even though number two doesn't want him dead, and even though they don't want to harm him, it is possible that he'll die. And that gives us some opportunity for number six to escape from peril that really is there, as opposed to a peril that's stay. For example, he could easily have died in Many Happy Returns out on that ship for that raft.
Yes.
Their plan involved a certain amount of risk that could have killed him. So they were willing to gamble with his life to a point. So they could be, and particularly if it's an earlier episode, you don't know that, you know, there's a real chance of him dying. There's a real chance that Rover might kill him, even though Rover's not supposed to kill him. I mean, there's all of these things could happen. So I don't know. It felt like at the end that number two was telling him that now that he's dead, the villagers aren't going to chase him anymore. But that kind of implies that they were going to chase him until he died, which means they are out of her control, or under the control of the order of the court, however you want to look at that. So, I don't know.
But I don't. I mean, in Arrival, we saw number two absolutely controlling all of the villagers. So that didn't really seem to be that credible.
Well, and we see that in this episode too. For example, when the town crier is declaring carnival and everyone is, they're not happy. Those are ghastly, passive faces who are doing what they're told.
It reminded me of the Happiness Patrol from Doctor Who.
Okay, yeah. Yeah.
Just thought you'd want to be reminded of that too.
Thank you so much. Yes. No, I've got an unhappy, passive face now. The cat. I didn't mention the cat in the synopsis, but there is a cat in the episode. Is the cat symbolic of his observer? The cat is number twos. The cat is following him around. The cat likes him, ends up liking him. And even in the morgue, number two says that, yes, the cat's mine. I'm jealous. She's grown attached to you. But she's mine and she's very ruthless. And number two or number six says, never trust a female, even the four-legged variety. But she could be describing the observer as well. The observer works for her. The observer is following him around. Mm. And she, too, has become attached to him.
Mm. Absolutely.
And, of course, the cat is mystical because number six jumps out of his window and the cat's on his bed. And 30 seconds later, the observer calls number two and the cat's sitting in her lap.
Yeah, I don't understand that. I think
that's
cats.
A continuity. I think that's a continuity gap. I don't think the cat was able to teleport, but unless it's
kitling. I wouldn't put it past them, you know. Cats, say. Wouldn't put it past them.
Not a cat person, huh? Well, now you know why, because they're between this and Survival on Doctor Who, another Sylvester McCoy reference in a single episode of The Prisoner. Let's see, what else have we got on this episode? The maid, she comes in a outfit earlier, and she's explaining how, you know, excited she is for going to the carnival. And then the next time she's not wearing her maid outfit, and the prisoner asks her, and she says, oh, I got a new costume for this special event. And of course, now that costume turns out to be, who she goes as, who ultimately ends up being a judge against, number six. So I think it's that point in the story that we know that it's all leading towards his trial for sure. So maybe, I don't know, you know, where is that? Was that after he found the radio? It might be.
It was, yeah.
So they might have altered their plan. I forget who she went as now.
I'm not too good on recognizing this, but could it have been Elizabeth first?
Oh, yes. Of course, that's right. She was wearing a Queen Elizabeth outfit.
Kind of hair.
Yeah. She's far better looking than Queen Elizabeth I ever was my understanding. Because I watch horrible histories. Anyway.
Well, I haven't seen that, but she certainly was very pretty.
Elizabeth, Napoleon, and Julius Caesar. So all three dead historical figures passing judgment, which is, according to the writer, he stole that from some film. And I don't remember which film it was, but it was a 1940s film in which three dead historical figures pass judgment on somebody. It's experimental film. The writer said that he wrote this with...
Is it a matter of life and death?
That sounds right. That actually sounds right.
I'm going to have to Google this afterwards. I think it might be a matter of life and death.
I think so. There was also another French filmmaker, Cocteau? I can't pronounce it. It's French. Cocteau, something of that nature. This script was based on his works. He was trying to evoke that sort of vibe, I guess, in these films. So I, you know, of course, how well the writer can do that without the director being on board. And I'm not saying the director wasn't on board, but you know, you can write a script and you can say, this is all very surreal. And then the director can shoot it very not surreal. And,
not in The Prisoner, though.
Okay. Say some like many happy returns, totally, totally straight. I mean, True. That was an action adventure story from where ago, but you come with something like Free For All or For Dance of the Dead. And there is just this sort of, I hate continuing to use the word surreal because it's not quite what I'm going for, but unreality to it. When the prisoner is sentenced to death, what does he do? He walks out of the room And it's not till he gets past the doors, then it's like robots being turned on and the villagers chase him. So with no apparent signal from number two or anything like that. So there is this stage drama unreality to it that wouldn't probably have happened if this were an actual village of prison and even brainwashed imprisoned people. So
yeah, but in a way that's part of why it feels to me like quite a good episode number two to have, because if you watch it in the original broadcast order, or in the ITC intended broadcast order, where the Chimes of Big Ben is number two, then immediately you're taken, it's another action adventure story, you're taken out of the village, you go through all the sequences at sea and end up in London, and then at the end obviously you get the reveal about it. All of that is out of the village, but you've only just arrived in the village. It's only been introduced in the pilot episode Arrival. So having an episode that is entirely set within the village and has this kind of heightened reality seems like a more appropriate second episode.
And I'm just looking at the production episode order. This is third.
Right.
After Free For All.
Right, yeah.
So,
I mean, the production order doesn't necessarily reflect the intended broadcast order, and obviously from the sound of the controversy that surrounds this, that would be far too easy for the prisoner.
There are way too many columns in the Wikipedia list of prisoner episodes saying which order it could possibly be in, for any sane TV show.
Yes, the prisoner society whose episode ordering I believe was used for the DVD discs, is that right? Or the,
I think I read that, yes.
Has it in third place after Free For All, same as the production order. But a couple of the other lists actually have it in second place, and that seems to me quite appropriate.
Yeah, it certainly feels second. It even feels earlier to me than Free For All did.
Yeah.
So, although in Free For All, I think he does ask him if he's settling in okay, so that would imply a very early episode.
Yeah, but another thing, and this is something that it has in common with Free For All, but which wasn't there in Chimes of Big Ben, at least as much I felt, is that in this episode you do get a very real sense of Number Six engaging and dueling much more with Number Two. So, and obviously Number Two is the most important character, if it's a single character, if he/she is a single character, but the most important role, position, besides Number Six in the series, mm-hmm. and in some episodes plays a minor or surprising role, or the twist about who Number Two turns out to be. This is a much more sort of straightforward one with a good kind of confident performance from Mary Morris. So you get much more of a sense of a battle between two powerful people, if that makes sense. And that seems like a good introductory thing, given the nature of the series.
Speaking of important characters in this episode, Number One gets a little bit more of a name check, even if not by name or number, in this episode. There's a more clear indication that Number Two has routine and regular communication with Number One.
Mm, yeah.
And reports regularly. Like, there's a scene, first off, the reason that at the end the prisoner gets into a room where he thinks Number One is, although it's not obvious to me how he figured that out, but we, the audience, have seen it a couple times through the course of the episode where Number Two is going in, and like the doctor who was trying to interrogate him early in the episode is asking, you know, to get instructions from whoever she's going in to see in this room. So there's also a scene, and I think it's very telling. She's on the phone to Number One, clearly, and she says, you know, oh yeah, carnival's tomorrow night, everything's great. Yes, I wish you could be here too. And then hangs up, and immediately her expression is one of enormous relief that Number One's not going to be there. I'm not sure what to take out of that, really. Is it Number One is so fearsome and formidable, or is it that, well, you just, you know, sometimes there's bosses you just never want to see, kind of thing? I don't know. It just adds another dimension to that dynamic between number one and number two.
Well, certainly reflecting on the dynamic from A, B, and C with Colin Gordon's number two, you certainly have the impression that number one is a fairly fearsome and unforgiving boss.
Yes, yes, I get that. But in those episodes, number two's not making any progress. Yeah, I mean, we as the audience know that number two has actually got something to be worried about.
Yes,
I think.
Yes.
In this episode, not so much. It just sounded like, you know, number one kind of casually says, yeah, I wish I could come by and visit for that. And number two's like, I don't want you here. Yes, yeah, sir, that'd be great. It'd be terrific. Sorry you can't make that, for whatever reason. So, again, kind of an earlier episode feel like we're explaining more things than we needed to.
Speaking of name checks, it did seem to me that this didn't really make much sense to me because it's obviously quite important, the numbers in the village. But Dutton kept getting called Dutton, not number 34 or whatever he was.
And yet Julius Caesar at one point said, no names, we don't use names here.
Yes, I mean, it gets mentioned as a rule, and of course, having seen the other episodes, we're very familiar with it. But the death notice or whatever it doesn't say number 34, it says Dutton's full name on it. And you wonder, you know, if that were number, if they ever decided they'd had enough of him and number six was for the chop, would the decree come through with his full name printed on
it? Was he 34?
Wasn't he 34?
I never was able to pick up his number, but 34 was the 34 was who the girl observer was watching before number six.
Yes.
And she's told he's dead. I don't know. Maybe
I assumed that was a reference to Dutton. I realized that he was seen alive after that point, but I thought that she was just being a bit previous.
Huh. No, I
as
didn't.
As in he's good as dead.
That would fit as well, but I just didn't. I never saw a number, and I never got. Could be right. Might try to go back and watch that again and see if there's a. See if he's got a number on him somewhere, but I don't even remember seeing him wearing a badge when he was on the beach or at the cave.
No.
I mean, he never calls himself.
No, he doesn't call himself by a number, and the prisoner obviously calls him by a name, and it's another of those unusual occasions where we have someone who the prisoner, I mean, we had it in Arrival in the pilot, we have someone who the prisoner actually knows from life before the village, so that from that point of view it kind of makes sense that he still has a name in the prisoner's eyes, but why the villagers should actually use his real name so often did seem a bit incongruous to me.
Yes, and I don't know. I really don't know. Unless it was, even that doesn't make any sense. What I was going to say is, you know, unless it's part of the game to play on number six, but I don't know what that would be. It's just incongruous, out of place. Yeah. So if he was 34, that would kind of make sense because you could say that the man who number 34 was is dead. In that way, in a sort of symbolic way, he's now their drooling fool. Although I'm not sure what that scene was supposed to tell us. It's like, are we just saying we've been playing you for a fool, number six? Is that simple? Or I don't know.
I think it was more of a sort of combination of a warning and you can't win, I suppose. There's, you know, your witness won't do you any good.
And by the way, we're about to kill you. So,
yeah.
So we didn't need to teach you this lesson because you're a dead man. I am. Couple production points I'll throw out from looking through the script again, which was an earlier draft apparently in the script book this time. So it's got you changed. One was that M. Number two was was a man in it, and was not that really made much difference, but it did change the costume. M. Wow, we're just gonna keep calling it M for today, aren't we? M because of Mary Morris is actually not Miles Messervy or Judy Dench, which doesn't have an M in it, but Dame with an M. It's an M in there. Was Jack the Ripper instead of Peter Pan.
Oh, well, that would have fitted with your dead theory.
Also, Mary Morris did a very controversial in 1947 version of Peter Pan.
Oh.
In which she played a Peter Pan as a gypsy boy, something like that. And I'm not too familiar with this. I'm just getting some background from the cliff notes. And even as late as 1967, that was considered one of the most controversial portrayals of Peter Pan ever. So whether or not there's anything to that, whether Mary Morris picked her own costume, whether or not the production crew said, hey, this is, you know, kind of, we can do Peter Pan. I don't know. I kind of like, you know, Jack the Ripper. How would you know, really? How would you know it's Jack the Ripper? Just a guy in a top hat and a cape and what I look at. So that's that was one thing that came out. There's an interesting cut line from the trial where the observer says he got, I don't know from where because he hasn't been interrogated, a radio, right? And the doctor, so Napoleon, I guess you want to call him in this case, says, why wasn't he interrogated? None of us are safe in our beds until everything is known about everyone here. Which, you know, keeps with the whole, you know, we know everything, we control everything. But it's interesting that he casts that in the role of public safety.
Mm.
You know, here is a show, even if you want to, can you, let's ask this question. If this show had taken place in modern times, do you think that number six, before he was taken to the village, would have had a Facebook account? Because I'm thinking no. I'm thinking no Twitter, no Facebook. You know, that does not, he definitely has that privacy vibe.
Yeah, if you updated the show, but you didn't update Patrick McGoohan, I think, no, he probably wouldn't. I somehow can't imagine it.
He really has that I'm just, you know, tightly controlled about everything. Or either that or he'd have, like, the world's most boring Facebook wall. Because it wouldn't have anything on it except, like, one word answers. So, yeah, it's here we can look at this and still draw a parallel. I have to give the show credit because it does provide us with things that we can look at today and still ask about our society. It hasn't aged out of relevancy as some shows do. So you can ask questions about whether or not, you know, do we give up privacy for security? Okay, that's probably has been going on for a long time, but and you can put it in context today. Not that, I mean, obviously it's perfectly safe with the NSA, but, you know, who else might have the information? Anyway, that was one. Another was, did you notice the weird dancing when number six was dancing with his observer?
He wasn't really dancing.
It was and it was very strange. He was kind of walking around. People were sort of milling around doing sort of different steps. It was all very chaotic, or and yet somehow, because it was like, felt like it was going around in a ring, almost like a race or a thing. He was supposed to be dancing with her,
but he wasn't really dancing. It didn't seem to me.
No, he was supposed to be dancing with her in the script, proper dancing.
Oh, I see. You mean in terms
and he
of
wouldn't
the production?
Do it.
Oh, right. Okay.
Do it.
So McGoohan wouldn't do it. Because, I mean, within the story, obviously number two is telling number six to go and dance with her.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears that he is kind of refusing to do it.
But yeah, and that kind of fits again with the way the game is played in the village. I think all the changes that are made to the scripts, and so far pretty much everything I've seen, where they have him doing something, generally speaking, are a little bit of an improvement, or that they're a little bit, they make him a little more consistent across the board. But, you know, this is one where it wasn't for any character, or it wasn't, I guess it wasn't for, I suppose McGoohan could say that's my character, but this was just, he refused to do it. So, you know, that's too intimate for me. So, So very strange. And also, the original script did not end where it did. He now that he's declared dead, and the Observer has been released. So it's in the original. The Observer clearly has become involved with number six emotionally, invested in him. And the line still remains from number two that says she's no longer your Observer because she can't be involved. She can't be emotionally involved. But in the original, number six and the Observer walk off hand in hand, return to the carnival, which is full going dance, and they all dance together with Napoleon and Elizabeth and Julius Caesar. The five of them get into a line dance together, and that's where the episode ends. Like, because he's now one of the dead. Although still, Bo Peep, come on, people, keep your metaphors right or something. That one just throws that whole thing off. It's like, yeah, better that they cut that out, but it does make Dance of the Dead more explicit, the title of the story and what they're going for. So it also, there's, again, just like in many Happy Returns, there's a few spots along the way where bits have been cut out that make the prisoner more human. He shows more concern for Dutton, both at the cave when he says he's going to die, and he shows him more concern at the trial when he sees that he's been turned into an idiot. He shows some fear at the trial when he realizes they actually do mean to kill him now. And we hear more of the note that he wrote in the original script. It says basically, you know, he starts off, whoever may find this, and we hear that part. Then the next scene, he's reading the next part, and it says, I expect that I am to be murdered soon, and I want my killer to be brought to justice. And so I'm leaving this information to... And then in the writer attempting to really be surrealistic, because like I said, can the writer do that? We switch over to the voice of the dead guy, the dead sailor, and he finishes reading the note that as the prisoner is writing it out before it goes off to, he sails out to sea. And it just says, you know, I'm enclosing a map and I don't know where I am, but maybe you can find this place and bring these people to justice.
You can't just write in the voice of the dead guy. How on earth are we as viewers going to know it's the dead guy's voice? 'Cause
I know.
I mean, we haven't heard a lot from him up to that point.
Right, right, exactly. It is a strange idea, and it wouldn't have worked, and maybe that's why they cut it. But I think more likely we cut it is that they cut it because the prisoner actually sounds like he's worried. So they're going to kill me.
Yeah.
And all of those things tend to get excised from this show to make him into more of a Superman. Exactly. Well, it's the same writer and it's the same situation. Exactly. They go through and cut it out. Let's see. What else did I get out of this? Director never worked for the show again because he couldn't get along with McGoohan.
I'm detecting a pattern here.
Maybe that's why McGoohan gets to direct some episodes, is that he just can't get people to work with him. He's obviously a potentially a difficult man to work with. Anyway, as I say, I get more out of the episode on a couple of viewings, which I guess is a good thing. It either, or maybe it's a bad thing. Maybe it just says I didn't really get it the first two or three times. Or maybe it says I'm making stuff up, so I feel like I'm getting it. Or because, you know, this was a show that would have, or maybe they failed as a filmmaker because this show wasn't meant to be on a DVD that you could watch over and over or expect somebody here 40 plus years later be talking about.
That may be true, but I think, I mean, all of the episodes that we've seen so far, you could imagine watching several times and still find new things in them because they're not straightforward. There's a lot packed in and a lot of complexity, particularly compared to other shows of the era. So I think whether or not they could have foreseen that these things would be viewed again and again, I don't know. But certainly for the mere mortal viewing them, once isn't enough.
Yeah, I think that's true. And well, some episodes, like the general once is more than enough, but this one, yeah, you have to go into it with the attitude that they're trying to tell you something in a secondhand way, as opposed to a straight linear narrative like you would in Many Happy Returns, for example. Mm-hmm. I could watch Many Happy Returns many times. I don't think I pick up anything new in it, but it's fresh every time I watch it. I really like that episode. This one, I struggle with it to try to make it reconcile in my head. It's another one of those plots that seems like, is it a plot? I mean, I asked that. I mean, are they guiding him to that trial at the end of this episode so that they can declare him dead? Is that the whole point of this thing from the word go? Or is that just happy accident that it comes along that way? Or is this really something they actually do every year?
It didn't feel narrative heavy, can I put it that way? If you're asking about the plot, there's something there, but in some sense, it felt a bit more like Free For All, which I think you described as being a kind of series of vignettes, and they were kind of pointed and designed to be satirical. And in this one, I think they're less pointed, and it's more about just setting the scene and giving the atmosphere of the village and presenting some of the sort of surreal nature of life there. But conversely, it feels more coherent because of that, because it has a kind of a slightly more consistent mood to it, I suppose, and it doesn't need to make a point with every scene. It doesn't need to say all elections are a sham or whatever. It feels like maybe the writer and the production just having a bit more fun, I suppose, and a bit more of an explore of the character and the environment. And so from that point of view, I think I would be quite happy to rewatch it again straight away and enjoy rewatching it. And yes, maybe I wouldn't get as much as if I rewatched, say, Free For All, but I'd probably enjoy it more.
I will go with that. I enjoy this one more than Free For All. I will definitely go so far as to say that. I mean, there are things going on in this one that interest me. And in Free For All, they are just sort of, here's a scene. Take my point from it. I'm going to hit you over the head with it.
Yes.
And that not only gets tiring very quickly, but they use too much time to convey each one. Like the scene with the press reporters. Okay, I got what you're going for. I mean, it only takes about one question that I realize this is the facet that they're making fun of or satirizing. And let's move on to the next one then. It's like they're presenting me a series of bullet points and then they're taking too long to explain the bullet points. It's a PowerPoint presentation is what it is. It's like, okay, click on. I can read it faster than you can read it to me kind of thing. I'm sure that's happened to everyone, right? That's what everyone does at a PowerPoint presentation. They brings it up on the screen. You read it. And then 3 to 5 minutes later, the guy who's reading you the thing out loud gets done with it and then moves on to the next screen and you're playing Sudoku or something on the background. That's what I do. Not saying I did that during Free For All, but that is kind of the feel I get out of that one. Whereas this one, yeah, I'm not really interested in the carnival. That does not interest me. I mean, they keep the talk about the carnival never interests me in the story. That's not like something like, oh, I can't wait till we get to carnival and see what this is all about. It's the other things going on, finding the body, the radio, the girl, the observer, all those things contribute to the plot. And the big thing I'm supposed to be expecting at the end does not grab me throughout the story. And then it doesn't disappoint me at the end either, that it's all a sham, that, you know, everyone's just sitting around waiting for number two and not doing anything until she says, oh, okay, everybody dance. It's like, it's not really a carnival. It's a stage. It's a set. Okay. That one's, I got nothing more. Absolutely nothing else.
Well, I've got one small question for you, but I thought for a moment that there might be some info in this that hadn't come up before, because when they, at the beginning, they say we mustn't harm number six because we want to use him afterwards. And so that set me wondering, well, you know, once they've got the information from him, what is their plan exactly? And the only thing I could think of was, well, they want to send him back to London as a double agent. So I thought, in that case, they can't be, the village can't be working for London. It's got to be, they're not there about finding out why he resigned or what secrets he sold to the other side or whatever. They're not backed by the British Secret Service. But actually, I think I may have been wrong about that, because if they believed that he was actually passing secrets, maybe they do want to use him as a double. They just want to be able to feed secrets to whoever via him. So they would still be using him as a double agent. So I think probably I haven't got anything new there.
Well, I would say my thought, and of course this is building upon other episodes that we've seen, like, for example, in Chimes of Big Ben, where number two tells him that the village is a model of society and this is our own world. In the real world, we have need for secret agents. And if the village is a model of the real world, number six would be an enormously valuable asset, even if it was there in the village. If he was a high level, you know, what if he became number two? He could probably be a devastatingly effective number two if that's the type of work he wanted to do. So I'm not sure I ever got the feel that they wanted to send him back. And as you talk through it, if they're not being run by London, then I have always kind of got the impression that they are being run not by London, not by Russia, but that they're sort of a tendrils into those organizations kind of thing. So that maybe London and Russia don't even realize that they're being worked by the village, whatever the village organization turns out to be. So that you can have people in London who are a very high power, whether it's the colonel or Thorpe or can't remember the guy from Chimes of Big Ben right now, Fotheringay, who are there and are genuinely part of the organization, but they are doubles for the village in the first place. So, you know, maybe they do want to put him back working for the village, but not exactly working against London, but, you know, has an extra agenda above and beyond working for London. That's not quite the same as a double agent, but again, this is a weird show. So I don't know what they're going for. Clearly they want to use him, though. Clearly they think that once he becomes a member of the village society, he will be a productive member of the village society, as opposed to Dutton, for example. Didn't make the grade.
Yeah, who they don't think could be useful for whatever reason. But, I mean, like I say, even if you were a double, you could still read it either way. So even if that were the case, it still wouldn't tell us who number two is working for. So
it remains a mystery. But we'll see. We'll see. Perhaps we'll learn more as the series goes on. Or perhaps they will just continue to make it obscure and ambiguous and all those fun things that we get from Prisoner every episode. Well, Simon, thank you.
It's been a pleasure, as always.
And we will be back with another episode of The Prisoner one of these days, soon. Or something else, or who knows what will be next week. I don't even know what will be next week yet. So,
well, when we do come back to watch The Prisoner, we are actually at something of a crossroads. So if we're going to carry on with the ITC episode ordering, I think the next episode would be Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling.
Really? The dance. So number episode 9, Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling. Well, that's an interesting episode.
It's certainly the next one in my iTunes, and I think it was the original US air order.
That's the original ITC order, and then that's supposed to be the syndication order as well. Well, let's do... What would be our alternative approach?
Well, if we were to stick with the British air order...
I thought that was the British air order.
It was the British air order would be checkmated. It was the intended... order.
Then we'd go with checkmate.
Yeah.
Checkmate. Wow, that's a big jump. That's a big jump, because if you go, if you look at the ITV airing order, we would be Checkmate, hammer into anvil, it's your funeral, a change of mind, and then do not forsake me, oh my darling. Let's go with the...
Let's go with the ITC order.
ITC number. Let's go with do not forsake me.
There's some intention behind that. Even if some of the decisions, such as putting Dance of the Dead at number 8, are questionable.
Yeah. Okay. Do not forsake me, oh my darling, will be the next episode of The Prisoner. That's an interesting one, if I didn't say that. I already recognize what's weird about that episode. That's the important parts. Okay. Well, then, listeners, we hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol.
Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us, leave us a review on iTunes, or stop by and visit at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter, search for Fusion Patrol, or just drop us a note at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolfe.